a beauty.
Oh my goodness.
That is a beauty. Yes, sir. We have tornado. Oh, wow.
Today on Arts and Letters, we'll be talking with participant journalist Brantley Hargrove about the man who caught the storm. The life of legendary storm chaser Tim Samaras.
Storm chasing is a gamble. And for several weeks now, Tim has played the odds, wagering thousands of dollars in gas, lodging, food, and an obscene number of miles ticking ever higher on the odometer of the family Dodge Caravan. He has spent his days behind the wheel, watching the hours transform the land. In theory, the objective is simple enough. Find a tornado, get in front of it, drop the probes, and move the hell out of the way.
The story of one of America's greatest storm chasers on Arts and Letters.
Is that another one? Confirmed?
From the studios of KUAR in Little Rock, I'm J. Bradley Minnick. And welcome to Arts and Letters, a program providing opportunities for the celebration of the arts and humanities. Today, we'll be talking with Brantley Hargrove about his book, The Man Who Caught the Storm, The Life of Legendary Tornado Chaser Tim Samaras, published by Simon & Schuster.
In practice, Tim has come to terms with the fact that he is hunting ghosts. He got close in Pratt. He got close in Stratford. But the last few years have been a litany of busts and near misses. Perhaps he was wrong to believe that anything sets him apart from past hunters. Maybe the biggest issue with Toto wasn't the probe, but the foe. Unpredictable, untouchable, unbeatable.
We'll hear about Tim's early days growing up in Lakewood, Colorado, as a tinkerer.
As a kid, it wasn't enough for Tim Samaras to see that the gadgets around him worked. He had an irrepressible need to know how and why. The bane of his mother's household appliances, he dismantled her blender to see why the blades spun so fast. At 10 years old, he autopsied the television set in an attempt to determine how colors and shapes flashed across the screen. That these things worked perfectly fine before he took them apart was not something he seemed capable of taking for granted.
His work on mammoth conventional explosive tests at White Sands Missile Range.
This guy who started out, you know, just this middle-class dude from the suburbs of Denver, didn't attend a day of college in his life, and somehow became a leading explosive expert.
And his obsession with probing the inside of tornadoes.
There's a sequence, Tim learns, to Thunderhead Formation. At the dry line, the air current out of the west will often sit atop the air from the Gulf in what's called a capping inversion, or a cap. The top layer then acts like the lid on a heating pot, blocking the lower level air from rising until it has soaked up enough of the sun's energy to boil over.
Measurements from Inside the Beast on Arts and Letters.
Well into the 20th century, the tornado still resided more firmly in the world of myth than reality. Towns in tornado alleys seldom saw the vortex coming until it was already at the door.
Young child on the side of the road was looking for something to dream. All familiar images, and I began to think. Here I go once again.
And survivors rarely even had the language necessary to describe the malign force they'd witnessed.
Chasing the storm, chasing the
those who emerged from the worst modern tornado disaster, the 1925 monster that left a three-state trail of destruction, could only report that the culprit was a smoky fog or fell blackness that descended upon their towns. Until the early 1950s, official policy forbade even the utterance of the word tornado in weather forecasts. The government was convinced that citizens were no more sensible than stampeding cattle, that entire cities would descend into hysteria upon hearing the dread word, resulting in far more fatalities than the thing itself.
Journalist Brantley Hargrove,
the man who caught the storm, the life of legendary tornado chaser, Tim Samaras. Welcome.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
So, wow, it's stunning in a couple ways because, one, there's the story of Tim, and then there's the story of you in relation to the writing of this. And I love books about obsession and kind of folks who are completely obsessed with uncatchable objects. What was it that drew you to this story, this life?
Kind of saw in Tim's life a uniquely American story. This guy who had a mastery of high-tech electronic instrumentation, who could measure blast forces in every way you can imagine. Tim believed there was nothing in this world that couldn't be quantified. It was such a strong belief that when he looked out at the sky and saw these monstrous tornadoes, these symbols of power on the plains, he didn't see them as something inscrutable that could never be touched. Eventually, he became convinced that they could be, that they could be sampled, they could be understood, they could be measured, and he thought that he had the skills to do that. The cap can sometimes snuff out a brewing storm, or it can be the starting gun for the biggest behemoth of all. Here I go once again. If the volatile Gulf air can break the cap, chasing the storm, chasing the wind. It races upward, sometimes clocking more than 100 miles per hour. Thunderheads like mountains in the sky form in moments, all out of a remarkable alchemy of humidity, temperature, pressure, and flow. All out of ingredients that the diligent chaser can monitor and log.
Large tornado on the ground.
So you said he had his high school degree, but he was really, and you used the word tinkerer, right. And his father was a tinkerer too a little bit. Tell us about his early life, and he's growing up in Denver.
Lakewood, Colorado, just outside of Denver. A lot of his life was spent holed away in his bedroom. He would steal away in there with his mom's blender or the television set, and he would dismantle them. You know, the consternation of his parents. He would take these things apart just to see what it was that made them tick. He needed to understand. He just had this incredibly inquisitive, precocious mind. And so his dad, because, you know, young Tim kept taking apart his stuff, eventually took matters into his own hands and put out an ad in the newspaper trying to get people to call him, and he'd go pick up their used electronics, and then he'd bring them back to Tim, and Tim would, if it was a busted old radio, Tim would fix it. So, I mean, he displayed this remarkable inclination from a very young age towards being able to look at a device, understand it, and if need be, fix it.
But he also becomes enamored by storms. Not only from seeing the movie The Wizard of Oz, but also he sees a tornado right outside his house.
Yeah, the first time he saw The Wizard of Oz, when he saw that vortex moving towards Dorothy and Toto, he was agog. I mean, he just couldn't believe that there were things like that in this world.
It's a twister! It's a twister!
And he wanted to be near them. And he actually got his first shot. He was a young kid. It wasn't much of a storm. There was a funnel cloud. It was never a tornado. It wasn't in touch with the ground. It was this funnel cloud that he could see from his house. In fact, I think he went to his neighbor's yard to watch it, just to be closer to it. You know, it was kind of, in some ways, his first chase, even though it was just next door. It was something that caught hold of him in a really profound way. And this little spark in him that would eventually just kind of grow hotter and bigger and brighter until eventually he went out and chased his first storms on his own. Tim teaches himself rudimentary forecasting the same way he taught himself electrical engineering. Before a chase, he plots a weather map on paper with an arrangement of dew points and surface observations, usually gleaned from a call to NWS at Boulder. After that, it's a matter of identifying the time and the place where the sky will explode, like a mountain of ammonium nitrate. To be able to predict, drive out,
and reap the reward of that first crash of thunder overhead? It's better than hearing any number of radios crackle back to life.
You know, we've seen certainly the storm chasers, but you're right, and I love this line, chasing is prognostication and timing. It's also luck, isn't it? It's pretty hard to find a storm, even if you know where it is in a sense. Tell us about the elusiveness of tornadoes.
They're incredibly hard to find. The best you can do, the best any chaser can do is, and this is what Tim would have done, there are computer weather models that can look ahead into what sorts of conditions might coalesce in the days and the weeks ahead. And so we'll watch those. We'll see what sorts of meteorological conditions are shaping up. What are the dew points in a certain area? Will there be any kind of backed winds? And a lot of it's just you're after a probability. You're seeing, okay, there is a chance here. There are a few sure bets. You know, sometimes there are. Sometimes the meteorological conditions will present such a signal that you're like, my God, all hell's about to break loose. But for the most part, you're chasing little probabilities and hoping that something sublime will happen.
Time 7:45, snail deployed. Large tornado to the north, about 5 miles.
So after he graduates from high school, he goes to work for?
It's the Denver Research Institute. It's an applied science and engineering outfit. They do all sorts of stuff. I mean, they're sort of jacks of all trade. They work for the military, testing explosives. One of the things he worked on is actually it's probably his first big projects at White Sands Missile Range. They had 400 tons of ammonium nitrate and fuel oil, just this big mountain of explosives. Rigged to blow that was supposed to simulate the blast effects of a nuclear explosion just without all the fallout. And Tim's job was to array around the site a series of ultra-high-speed cameras to catch the explosion and the resulting shockwave.
He felt every pulse of fist of smoke, fire, and soil as it rose from a 250-foot-deep crater.
These were experts. They were the best. That's why the federal government called on them. I mean, you know, imagine Tim goes from just hanging out on his boyhood floor in his bedroom, tinkering with electronics, to when he was in high school, he was managing, you know, this little mom and pop radio repair shop where he was just fixing stuff, low stakes. And then here he's working on White Sands Missile Range. You know, this is as high stakes as it gets, working on these massive projects. Tim was living his best life.
But at the time, he's still interested, and he goes up to the Red Rocks to watch storms.
Sure. His fascination with storms and tornadoes continued to abide, even though he wasn't chasing them yet. I don't think he had the language for chasing. I don't think he really had considered at that point that that was something that was possible to do, that people did. For the most part, it would have to suffice was driving his vehicle out to Red Rocks, you know, this makeout spot near Red Rocks. And if he knew a storm was going to come by, he would park up there and just watch it wash over him. But it was, you know, it was a sort of a stationary thing. It wasn't a storm chase.
We're talking with Brantley Hargrove about the man who caught the storm, the life of legendary tornado chaser, Tim Samaras. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Arts and Letters. Let's return to our conversation with Brantley Hargrove about his book, The Man Who Caught the Storm, the life of legendary tornado chaser, Tim Samaras.
Then, on a winter day in 1980, he met the woman who would become his wife.
I waited for you for a while. Just the thought of you makes me smile. When I get to see your face, takes me to wish him I see a smile tonight.
Kathy Vidatich had big, watchful blue eyes above high cheekbones, framed by permed brown hair. Formerly of DRI's travel office, where she made accommodations and booked flights, she had recently been transferred to the chemistry division when Tim strolled up to her desk to request a few thermometers for an oil shale project. Kathy couldn't help but appraise the trim, dark-headed young man.
When I see your curly hair,
he meets his to-be wife, Kathy Vidatich. And you know, you think maybe he'd settle down, but the opposite happens.
Right, well, it's after the birth of his third child, his son, Paul, that the storm chasing begins. I mean, you know, he's a father of three, so he's got storm chasing.
With my head in the clouds, I'm just hoping this will last a while. I pretend
yeah, he saw this show on TV. It was a Nova documentary about these scientists who'd built this device called TOTO, Totable Tornado Observatory, that they wanted to get inside a tornado because we had no data from inside a tornado at ground level. That was a blank spot. We had no idea really what went on there. We had conjecture theories, but nobody really knew because we'd never been able to sample it because it's so dangerous. I mean, it's so hard to get any kind of instrument into the core of a tornado because they're so unpredictable. So he saw these guys out here with this instrument, and they were chasing tornadoes to get their instrument inside them. That was what sort of, I think, dawned on him, this idea of not just passively waiting for storms to come into town, but to actually go and find them. And that's what he started doing, you know, kind of cautiously at first.
And people had been using pods, hadn't they, up to this point, to try and get inside of them? I mean, people had been trying.
Right. There were a few iterations of, after TOTO, there was a thing called the Turtle, the E-Turtle, partly what inspired what Tim tried to do, that got really close. They got, I think, within a few hundred yards of a large, violent tornado in Texas. But, I mean, you know, it was close. It was closer than anybody had really gotten and managed to get a good sample. But it wasn't the core strike. It wasn't in the heart of the tornado, you know, that sort of singular measurement that everyone was hoping for.
So what did Kathy think about all this? Because, you know, I mean, he has three kids, two girls and a boy, and he's out there chasing tornadoes. And is he still working with the explosives too?
Oh yeah, he's still off chasing tornadoes, or he's off at a test range or something like that. Tim had to travel a lot. Mm-hmm. And I think as long as he fulfilled his responsibilities as a father and a husband, which he did by all accounts, I think he was a great dad. You know, he was his daughter's Girl Scout troop leader. He was there. And I think Kathy's approach to it was, she could see how happy this made him. And she didn't want to stand in his way. You know, I think she felt that he could do some good out there, and she didn't want to keep him from this thing that he so clearly loved. And he is a collector, after a fashion, but of images and experiences, not things. The trophy is the right forecast. It's being able to say he was there, that in the vastness of the plains, he found the needle.
I love the title, This Love Affair with the Sky. Was it as much about trying to figure out how to get inside the tornado and measure the pressure and the things that people wouldn't know, the science, as it was the art or the thrill?
He was an incredibly curious person, and I think he wanted to know what was happening in there. I think he wanted to know just as much as any PhD scientist, even if he didn't have the education to fully understand all the mathematics behind it. And I also think Tim loved a challenge. Here are all these scientists in the ivory towers of academia who failed to pull this thing off, who have tried to go at the tornado and to get their devices inside the core and haven't been able to do it, haven't managed it. And so I think Tim saw it as a challenge. These people said it couldn't be done, and so he's thinking, well, I haven't tried it yet. Finally, there were a vast number of questions that Doppler would never be able to answer. The technology could say nothing about the temperature, humidity, or pressure inside the tornado. These are the fundamental data points of meteorology. What scientists consider essential to knowing where the wind will go, where it comes from,
there she blows,
and what exactly is driving it.
Oh, it's a beauty.
Oh my goodness.
No fine-grained predictions of tornadic behavior would be possible without them. And so he's thinking, well, I haven't tried it yet. And I'm a different breed of cat here. I mean, I'm an inventor. My device is not like your device. I mean, my device is informed by the test range.
Right.
It's engineered. And I'm a storm chaser, and I'm a really good storm chaser. He knew that he was as good at finding tornadoes and at maneuvering around them as anyone alive. And so I think he believed he had a real shot at this. I think part of it was his love of invention, the challenge, and, I mean, sure, the excitement. I mean, who can deny
and
how
he had
thrilling
to, and
that
he had to get
be.
Close to them. He was close to these things. He was taking planned risks, but his wife was pretty concerned, right?
Right. That was part of the mission. If you're trying to get a probe inside the core of a tornado, you can't really play it safe, because if you play it safe, if you deploy too far from the tornado, you're going to miss it. Tornadoes don't travel all the time in straight, predictable lines. You know, I mean, they move all over the place. They zig, they zag. So to have any confidence that your probe is going to go inside, you have to deploy basically until you can see the whites of its eyes. I mean,
right.
You have to wait until the very last minute. And I think that was something that Tim was realizing over successive deployments where he was failing. I think he realized just how close he needed to be to succeed at this mission. And the answer to that turned out to be really, really horrifyingly close.
I'm sorry, guys. This is too close for me. I am not going in there.
Too close?
So in 1997 in the spring, he receives an unexpected phone call from a man who's a mechanical engineer named Frank Tatum. And this was a kind of a turning point for him, wasn't it?
Yeah, well, it was sort of the proverbial bolt from the blue.
So what does Frank want?
So Frank is this guy from Huntsville, Alabama, who has developed this device that was inspired by a really horrific tornado disaster in that city. This tornado had come through and it killed some people, and the whole town was just horrified by this. And in the aftermath, Frank had heard a bunch of really weird stories from people who had been in basements and had felt the ground vibrating as the tornado approached. They had felt, I mean, what felt like, you know, tremors, like actual tremors through the ground. And when he investigated this a little more, actually went to the USGS office, they actually had documented with their geophones, their seismic sensors, an actual seismic signal transmitted into the ground by the tornado's violent force. I mean, that's how astonishingly powerful these things are. They can actually transmit their force through the earth. And so it gave him an idea, and his idea was, well, you know, if we can track these things, we can sense their seismic pulses through the ground, maybe that can serve as some kind of early warning network. And so he set about building this, I mean, really very simple device. I mean, it was a recorder attached to a geophone, which detects seismic signals, housed in a sink basin. So his idea was, you know, you place some of these, you ring them around a city, they can detect the signals from a tornado and give everybody some advance warning. And so that's why he reached out to Tim. I mean, he just kind of randomly called Tim, explaining what he had invented and asking Tim if Tim wouldn't be interested in trying to deploy these
near a tornado just to see if they actually work. Tatum was an engineer. He'd never storm chased before. He didn't know the first thing about finding tornadoes and getting near them. So he'd reached out to Tim because Tim had sort of developed a profile at this point as a well-known storm chaser.
One of the big problems, it seems to me, was keeping the probe on the ground when these unbelievably high winds were coming around. That was one of the issues, right?
Sure. Well, yeah, the Totable Tornado Observatory, the first time it encountered a strong tornado, it got knocked over on its side and actually damaged its sensors. So that was an issue. These things weren't engineered necessarily to survive in that kind of environment. I don't think the people designing them necessarily had the background to be able to do that. And that's what set Tim's device apart from everything that had preceded it. Finally, after much deliberating and revision, Tim nails the design. A squat cone some 20 inches in diameter and a little less than 6 inches tall. He calls it the Hardened In-Situ Tornado Pressure Recorder, or HITPER for short.
You're listening to Arts and Letters. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Arts and Letters. Let's return to our discussion with journalist Brantley Hargrove as he talks about his book, The Man Who Caught the Storm, the life of legendary tornado chaser Tim Samaras. Tell us about some of the failures. I love these sections.
Time 7:45, snail deployed. Large tornado to the north, about 5 miles.
They're chasing one after the other, and they can't catch the thing. They overshoot it.
Well, yeah, I believe in 2001, he went out with this National Geographic crew as part of kind of a broader effort. I think they just did not have a whole lot of luck that whole season. Yeah, so this is May 15th, 2003. Once again, Tim is heading out onto the plains to try to see if he can intercept a tornado. And it looks like things are lining up nicely in the panhandle of Texas. Clouds as dull as slag have choked off the light of a late spring sun, bringing an early dusk to the panhandle. The asphalt is wet and shining like obsidian from the passing storm. Tim guides the minivan through town, craning his neck for a glimpse of the western horizon through the gaps between trees and the little houses with dusty hardpan lawns. That's when he catches sight of it, a lowering too deep to be the wall cloud of the mesocyclone. Too solid, too big, too well-defined for a false alarm scudnado. Though Tim glimpses the shape only for an instant, his every instinct signals tornado. Simon doesn't see it yet, off to the northwest, but he knows Tim isn't in the habit of crying wolf. He begins filming through the windshield for the scientific record.
A wedge on the ground. Wedge on the ground. Wipe us, please.
25:21. Time, 22:45:21, Simon narrates. We're going to take a look.
Oh, Jesus.
Stratford's residential sector sweeps past, its water tower, then a series of corrugated steel buildings. Tim accelerates, and the minivan's motor thrums. At a break in Stratford's meager skyline, Tim spots the silhouette at last.
Oh my God, got a wedge on the ground.
Oh my God, he says. We've got a wedge on the ground.
Wedge on the ground.
Wedge on the ground, Simon repeats, though we can't quite see it through the rain-bleared windshield.
Wipers, please.
Wipers, please. The blades slash across the glass. He pans the camera frame over the northwestern horizon, where the cloud bank hovers parallel to the smooth plain of the prairie, then suddenly plummets to earth. There it is, the telltale funnel.
Wedge tornado on the ground.
Oh, Jesus, he gasps. Wedge tornado on the ground. They race northwest out of town, down 287. And 10 minutes later, Simon is filming through the driver window. A series of vortices,
ride the outer rim of a broad tornadic circulation before fading, replaced by other thin twisters.
Very large tornado.
This is a classic multiple vortex tornado. As they enter the rain curtain at the front of the storm, the tornado drifts neither left nor right. Instead, it only advances, growing ever larger. The beast is coming for them. Or rather, they're coming for it. Tim advises Simon to prepare himself for the hail core, which runs up against the outer edge of the updraft. They are entering no man's land, the place considered too close, a violation of storm chasing's cardinal rule. It's not so much frightening to find themselves so close as it is surreal. What they're doing isn't storm chasing anymore. It's something else. Tim knows they don't belong here, but this is what it takes. The snap of baseball-sized hail against the roof brings them back to the reality of their position.
Tim, you gotta get out the car and just be careful.
Oh my God, that was, Tim? You gotta get out of the car in this. Be careful.
Okay, you're in position, Tim.
Tim sees the tornado churning toward their stretch of highway, closer now and maintaining the same trajectory. Apart from the hailstones large enough to kill, the duo are in perfect position for a turtle deployment. Ready, Tim says.
Okay, ready? Yeah.
He swings the minivan around to the opposite lane, the cabin resounding with the erratic tattoo of heavy ice against metal.
Watch your head, my friend.
Watch your head, my friend, Simon cautions, and looks out onto the approaching circulation, a diffusion of drifting cloud and tightly spun vortices.
It's very close in.
Tim, it's very close in. The vortex is approaching at nearly 35 miles per hour. You're in position. You're in position.
Okay, you're in position, Tim. You're in position.
Before Tim can open the door, there comes a startling thwack against the roof, heavier than before. That was huge.
Yeah, I don't know.
I don't know, Simon says. You can't go out. Tim ignores him. Let's go.
Okay,
debris half a mile in closing. Tim drives roughly 50 yards back to the south in an attempt to escape the hail core, watching for the left or right drift. He slams the brakes. Okay, let's go. Simon begins to step out, but the roof of the minivan rings with another deafening impact. Tim shouts, woohoo!
Oh, watch yourself, Tim.
He crawls from the front seat into the back.
Take some huge hailstones out here.
Lifts a floor panel and begins to extricate a turtle. Tim grimaces as he hefts the tire-sized object.
I've got an eye on the tornado, don't worry. All right, how are we doing?
We've got baseballs falling.
How are we doing, he asks. We've got baseballs falling. Simon winces at the pearlescent orb streaking to earth.
Tim, these will take your head off, man.
These will take your head off, man. Just sling a thing out. Wind's increasing slowly.
Watch
your head.
Wind's increasing slowly. Watch your head.
Tim ducks out of the van, holding the turtle high above his shaggy crown of hair as a shield. Hailstones thud dully against the grass all around him. He drops the device some 15 feet from the minivan. He casts a quick glance at the approaching tornado, then lifts his hands defensively as he runs back to the vehicle.
Watch your head, watch your head, watch your head.
Watch your head, watch your head, watch your head, Simon shouts. The camera registers the sound of the sliding door slamming shut.
Can you hear it?
Time, 21:58.
Can you hear it, Tim says.
Jesus, can I ever hear it?
Unmistakable glee in his voice as he lunges into the driver's seat. He's not talking about the thud of hail, then. A low amplitude roar emanates from the tattered clouds spiraling towards their direction. It's a steady, unstoppable crescendo. Can I ever hear it? Simon says. Okay, time 22:58:17. GPS set point. The minivan tears along the highway as the rain overtakes them, and the wind screams out of the south. Simon looks over at Tim. He is clutching the steering wheel as though his life depends on his grip. They can barely see the road ahead. You might want to slow down a little bit, Simon urges. But Tim doesn't let up, even as he struggles to maintain control of the vehicle. No, His voice betrays the shadow of an emotion that doesn't often cross Tim's confident exterior. The wind intensifies, buffeting the minivan over the lanes, driving into them broadside like a lowered shoulder. The right side of the vehicle is beginning to lift perceptibly. Tim believes the tornado is about to overtake them. "We're gonna die," he says, gripped by a pure animal fear. He sounds like a man who's just discovered his own terrible mistake. They have pushed too far, tempted fate. All that's left now is to learn the cost of violating Chasing's one rule.
"Left side, Tim. The power poles could come down here." "Okay, good. Beautiful. Send left side. We're easy over 100 miles an hour. Power poles are..."
Simon tries to reassure him. What he's experiencing isn't the tornado itself. It's likely the outer circulation. Too close, but still escapable. The minivan tunnels blindly through walls of violent, gale-driven rain. The bright yellow highway dividing lines fade beneath gray currents. "Oh my God," Tim mutters. He shoves the accelerator to the floor. "Slow down, Tim," Simon urges. "Slow down, slow down. Wind's at 100 miles per hour." To the right, a power pole cants into their lane. More fall. Others bow like pliant saplings, looking as though they might topple into the road at any moment. "Power lines down, left side," Simon directs. "You don't want the power poles to come down on you." Tim swings into the oncoming lane to avoid them. "Beautiful," Simon cries. "Wind's easily over 100 miles per hour now. The power poles are bending. I've never seen that in my life. They're bending. More power lines down. Slow down. Slow down." The headlights of cars shine in the gloom ahead, behind a series of looming poles and their arcing transformers. Tumbleweeds skitter before them. Then, as quickly as the rain curtains had enveloped them, the sky clears. The light pales again. Rain falls gently. Tim and Simon regard each other with wide eyes and manic, adrenal grins. "You did it," Simon says. "Well done, my friend. Well done." "That was expletive close," Tim sputters. "That was beautiful," Simon says, as Tim finally begins to throttle down, to relax his grip on the wheel. "That was perfect."
Who's Simon?
Anton Simon is this. Was the guy who put together that first National Geographic expedition.
Got it.
And he would sort of travel with Tim for a couple seasons after that.
And yet after all that, they still were unable to get the probe inside the tornado. You're listening to Arts and Letters. Let's return to our conversation with Brantley Hargrove about his book, The Man Who Caught the Storm. So he gets his big break with the tornado in Manchester, South Dakota, 2003.
This is in June 2003, which is very late in tornado season. By that point, things are quieting down. Once you get into July, I mean, they're pretty much dead in the plains. He's got some National Geographic funding, but so far he hasn't been able to produce that singular intercept. He hasn't gotten the measurement that he's been after all these years. And so, you know, he's out there chasing. He gets onto a really powerful tornado, I believe it was an F3, and chases this thing, and it's a terribly frustrating afternoon because as he's driving along, he's got this rope tornado just absolutely just shredding the cornfields and the wheat fields. And it's staying out there in those fields, which is a problem for Tim because Tim can't deploy in muddy cornfields or wheat fields. He needs a road because he can't just drive out there. He can't run out there with his 50-pound, 60-pound probe. The fact that it never crosses a navigable road, it's a source of huge frustration. It dissipates, and Tim is kind of left there wondering if, you know, this was his last shot for the season. Yet another year, yet another disappointment. He doesn't have that deployment that he's been after. You know, at this point, he's gathering up the probes that he deployed that, you know, were not struck. He's disconsolate. It's a disappointing day. It's a bad afternoon. And at this point,
You know, as he's gathering his probes, one of his compatriots who's with him is a guy who is kind of serving as a guide for the National Geographic photographer who's shadowing Tim, notices that the sun is reflecting off the backside of this big thunderstorm off in the distance, off in the east. And Tim takes a look at it, kind of perks up a little bit, and goes and peeks at the radar feed he has in his minivan. You know, when he looks in there, he sees a hook echo, which is the presentation on radar that indicates that there may be, not that there is, but that there may be a tornado on the ground. The storm looks really good on radar. And so he's throwing all of his probes in the back of the minivan, gathering them up as quickly as he can, and then tearing off east towards Manchester, South Dakota. It's this little tiny farming hamlet, by that point mostly uninhabited. I think maybe there was a few people still living there, but for the most part it had been depopulated. And so he's heading that way, hoping that there's something waiting there for him.
And there was.
Oh, there was, yeah. Manchester, South Dakota, F4 was what I believe was the biggest, most powerful tornado Tim had encountered in his life at that point. I mean, this was the beast that he had been roaming the plains for years trying to find. He'd never seen anything like this before. And here he is racing towards it down a little South Dakota highway with a bunch of probes in the back. And this is a shot, in a sense, at immortality. If he can get his probes inside this thing, everybody will remember that, you know, at least everybody who knows about tornadoes will know the name Tim Samaras.
Right.
So as he's heading down this highway, you know, the tornado's approaching it, heading sort of generally northeast, and he realizes that he can't do it. The tornado, it's coming close to the road. There isn't time to get out there, deploy a probe on the highway and get away in time. I mean, it'd be suicide. Mm-hmm. And Tim realized that. He's not that reckless. He doesn't have a death wish by any stretch. So he just kind of pulls off to the side, takes a look at his map. He's got this little VGA computer monitor in the minivan that can display a DeLorme roadmap, which chasers live and die by, a good roadmap. And he sees that, you know, okay, it's not ideal, but we do have a grid of dirt roads to the north, and we can use them. It wouldn't be anybody's first option, because when dirt roads get wet, they become muddy bogs, and you don't want to get bogged down with a tornado nearby. So he decides he's going to go for it. He's like, hell with it. You know, I may never get a shot like this for the rest of my life, honestly. So he decides, I'm going to go north, and we'll see what happens.
Is he with somebody at the time?
Yeah, at this point he's with his brother-in-law, Pat Porter.
Right.
Yeah, it's his brother-in-law who lives down the street.
Oh, man.
So Pat would be the first to admit this. I've seen the footage of this. Pat's, I mean, fully freaked out. But, you know, I mean, they actually do slow up to watch the destruction of Manchester. That tornado goes right through Manchester. They're watching houses go up into the sky. I mean, very, very Wizard of Oz type stuff. I mean, you can see in their video these houses being lifted and just, you know, lofted into hundreds of feet into the air. And so, you know, they sort of pause to kind of watch this sort of in silence. And then, you know, they're like, well, we got to go. Okay. So what Tim realizes he's got to do is he's got to go north. And, you know, that's not going to bring him into intersection with the tornado, because the tornado is going northeast. So he's going to have to take the next east route to head the tornado off at the next intersection, drop his probe, and get out of there before the tornado runs him over. And so it's a race. He's racing the tornado towards this intersection. And the worst case scenarios start unfolding. They get into the rain bands surrounding the tornado. The road starts getting wet. They're fishtailing in it. It's bad. At one point, I do recall him saying, do not get stuck. Because he knows how dire the situation is. I mean, I can't imagine what it had been like being in that car with Tim. But they get there ahead. Tim jumps out. As he jumps out, he's yanking the probe out of the back of the minivan.
And things are kind of the size of a tire, right?
They're about the size of a tire. They're about 50 or 60 pounds. They're not light. But Tim switches it on, kind of just waddles with it over to the side of the road, plops it down. Meanwhile, housing insulation is beginning to drift down on them, light debris from the tornado. It's ripping up the next farmhouse over and casting its debris ahead of it, and it's starting to float down around them. That's when you know you are
really close.
You're in the danger zone. And so Tim is, you know, he's sprinting back into the minivan, jumping behind the wheel and tearing off down the road, going straight north with this monstrous tornado just looming blackly in profile behind him. Tim's kind of, I think he's sort of looking straight ahead, but, you know, kind of glancing into the rearview mirror, you know, seeing this monstrosity behind him. As it's going through this, he deployed right next to a little farmhouse. It's going through this farmhouse and just destroying it. And they have to wonder if anybody's there. But they get away. I mean, just barely. I think between the time that he dropped his probe and activated it till the time it registered the tornado strike was, you know, I want to say it was maybe a little over a minute. Not very much time to elapse.
But
the probe goes in. In the lamplight of the shabby room, Tim's eyes dart over the numbers registering the pressure drop Hitper has recorded. The pressure drop the turtle logged, using technology Tim had developed on the test range years before, is the steepest pressure deficit on record, confirming what scientists believed but could never prove. With a back-of-the-envelope calculation and a few assumptions about the vortex structure, the probe's pressure ports registered winds in excess of 200 miles per hour, well within the F4 range. When he takes that probe back to a motel and starts downloading the data, I mean, he finds that he has a core strike. He got the first ever measurements from the core of an extremely violent, powerful tornado, the steepest drop in barometric pressure ever recorded on Earth.
So he did it.
Yeah, he did it.
They yell, "You've done it. You've done it, Tim." And he becomes famous.
He's legitimate now in the minds of a lot of scientists. I mean, people want to work with him now. And I think that was something Tim desperately wanted. I think he wanted to be seen as a peer, as somebody to be taken seriously, somebody who had something to offer. You know, I think to be taken seriously by these people who he respected and revered, it was a big moment for him.
So he creates his own team
right
in 2005, and you call them a team of upstarts.
All right, TwistX. There's this group that he started with Bruce Lee and Kathy Finley, these two research meteorologists who were a lot like Tim in a lot of ways. They had gotten their own grants, sort of operated independently, small scale on a small budget. They worked in the private sector, and so, you know, they could kind of understand where Tim was coming from, working in the private sector but trying to do hard research. For the first time since 2011, a small TwistX team assembles at the Samaras compound in Bennett, Colorado. On May 18th, 2013, Tim, Carl, Paul, and Ed Grubb are gearing up to hunt down the swirling winds. In a way peculiar to storm chasers, their departure for the plains feels like a homecoming, even though they have no fixed destination. They haven't seen much of each other lately, but as the men pull away from Bennett in the GMC, it's as if the last TwistX mission were only yesterday.
So he's had a bunch of brushes, right? And then the successful one was kind of a brush too. What happens in 2013?
And so they were supposed to be set up somewhere in kind of northwestern Oklahoma. And I think they just couldn't resist going down and going for a chase. And they had planned for that. They'd brought along one of those little Chevy Cobalt sedans that they'd used for the mezzanettes. They'd brought that along with the Lightning Intercept vehicle to go on little side chases. And I think they had some funding from National Geographic to do that. So it was just the kind of setup that they couldn't pass up. Another big one's on the way. We're going to see this.
Right.
So they drove south and got set up west of Oklahoma City, you know, late afternoon. And things started to pop off pretty fast.
So what happened?
The tornado dropped quickly, intensified quickly, and they were just sort of struggling to keep up from there. The road network kind of conspired against them. Yeah. The tornado was moving fast. It was rain-wrapped for a lot of its life cycle. And for just a lot of reasons, it was a difficult chase. And they were intent, I think, on deploying one of his probes on it, but they had a hard time getting into any kind of position. I mean, it was just, it was all they could do to keep up with it. And so this, you know, this beast just materialized out of the rain before they could react to it. And it took their lives, unfortunately. You know, I think you play in the beast's shadow enough times
eventually it's going to turn on you. And that's really what happened here. Tim came up against something he couldn't predict, couldn't expect, couldn't track. It was a matter of not enough information, just not knowing what you were up against.
So what would you say his legacy is?
Well, I think, if anything, he showed us that it was possible to get data from the core of a violent tornado. He proved that that was something that could be done. And there are other people who are proceeding along in his footsteps. Mm-hmm. I think his data is going to become increasingly useful. And so I think posthumously, his data is going to be of more utility to the scientific community than ever was while he was alive. Storm chasers are nothing if not connoisseurs. They've fallen over size, symmetry, clear contrast, and clean lines. And this tornado has it all. With the sun setting in the background, a sliver of its trailing edge shines cantaloupe orange. The remainder of its bulk reflects a bone gray calcite. The structure is enough to leave the group in awe. From the cloud base, it descends as straight as a stovepipe, bulging near the center, before narrowing gradually at first, then sharply near the surface. The tip finally vanishes behind a churning bowl of tilled sod. They pursue for half an hour until the funnel lifts from the fields and retreats back into the clouds, like the tapering tail of a bull snake receding into tall grass.
That is beautiful!
There it goes, Tim shouts over the idling diesel. The wind begins to ease, and they hear the silvery sound of birdsong.
Broadcast from the studios of KUAR in Little Rock, you've been listening to Arts and Letters. Thanks for joining us. To check out past episodes, go to artsandlettersradio.org. Thank you to musician and songwriter Ashton Barbary. Thank you to composer Joseph Fuller for the original music and for the title track, accompanied by Robert Campbell and Michael Fuller. Thank you to composer Michael Shackelford. A special thanks to Anton Simon for the video from the May 15th, 2003 storm chase. Thank you to Adam Simon of Simon Sound for mastering the episode. Thank you to Sticky's Rock and Roll Chicken Shack for keeping music alive and well in Arkansas. Generous funding for Arts and Letters was provided by the Arkansas Humanities Council and the National Endowment for the Humanities. Thank you to participant journalist Brantley Hargrove for so eloquently and earnestly helping us to understand Tim Samaras' quest to find the perfect storm. This show is dedicated to the incomparable, the amazing, the wonderful and wise William Wagner. For Arts and Letters, let's heed these words from the film Twister. When you used to tell me that you chased tornadoes, deep down, I thought it was just a metaphor.